The invisible hand of the market. Is it some kind of impersonal force? Or something we set up, and therefore something we can change?
The kind of centerpiece is that notion that the economy is an autonomous thing. It's something that regulates itself. Its inner laws must be obeyed. And so the reason that we can't raise the minimum wage or take dramatic action to change from carbon-based fuels to renewables is that would interfere with the self-regulating mechanisms of the economy. And this idea is just, when you think about it seriously, bizarre.
That's Fred Block. We talk with him about his book, Capitalism, The Future of an Illusion. Then, the majority of the American electorate is supposed to lie somewhere in the middle between left and right. But is that really true?
And it turns out that people don't line up the way you think they might, that there are actually four groups of voters, not just two, not left-right. It's more complicated. And one of the groups is the smallest, and that's the moderate, social, liberal, economic conservative. So you could view, for example, Hillary Clinton that way, that she was good on social issues, but she didn't want to fight with Wall Street. She didn't want to declare war on the billionaire class. She was about equal opportunity, but not very much about equal results. And I think the same could be said maybe for Gillibrand, Booker, Kamala Harris. They're leaning more in that direction, and I think that that's a loser.
That's Les Leopold, author of Runaway Inequality. We talk with him about his article on Common Dreams, Beware the Moderate Democrat. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. With all its trillions of transactions, the economy seems to most of us to operate outside the range of human control, and that if you intervene, you'll destroy jobs or the ability to make a profit. My guest Fred Block says this is an illusion. In reality, capitalist economies are heavily shaped by politics, social power, and governmental action. And slowly, people are beginning to understand the reality behind the illusion and seeking to level the playing field for all. That's really what democratic socialists like Bernie Sanders and AOC are doing when they call for changes within capitalism to, as they say, make the economy work for everyone. It's also why Elizabeth Warren says capitalism has to be regulated so it doesn't rig the system in favor of those at the top. In his book, Capitalism, The Future of an Illusion, economic sociologist Fred Block argues that restoring the vitality of the United States and the world economy can be done only with major reforms on the scale of the New Deal. In other words, he says, society can guide the wheel of the market to steer it in a fair direction. Fred Block is research professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. In addition to Capitalism, The Future of an Illusion, he's the co-author of The Power of Market Fundamentalism. Well, Fred Block, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So this is a fascinating title, Capitalism, The Future of an Illusion. Why an illusion?
Well, my argument is a little bit convoluted, but it's essentially that basically, 50 years ago, the term capitalism belonged to the left. It was very much a legacy of the radical movement, of the socialist movement, and people on the right and on the center didn't use the term capitalism, particularly in the U.S., because it was so much associated with the radical left and with the Soviet Union critique of American society. Over that last 50 years, the term moved from being associated with the left wing to a consensual term. Everybody now describes our system as capitalism, left, right, and center. And in that shift, I see not a victory, but a defeat, because the conception of capitalism, which has become taken for granted by pretty much everybody, is that it's an unchanging, unchangeable system whose inner logic must be obeyed, or we will suffer grave economic consequences like a dramatic fall in our standard of living. And it's that idea which I think is an illusion, because the reality is that if you look at the history over 200 or 300 years of the societies that are defined as capitalist, the reality is of constant change, of major institutional transformations, of periods of dramatic social and economic reform. And the idea that you can't change or modify this way of organizing things is just historically incorrect. And so the final part is that I think that's been a part of our political battle over the last 3 or 4 decades, that the right has been extremely successful in saying, no, you can't change any of this because it was like the Ten Commandments handed down from Mount Sinai. It's the very nature of the system that we have, and it can't be modified. The reality is exactly the opposite. So I wanted to open up a conversation about what is, in fact, possible.
You know, it's interesting that, in 2016, Bernie Sanders brought the idea of democratic socialism, which to a lot of people who have a sense of history really looked a lot more like FDR capitalism. In other words, what some people call social democracy. It's almost as if people can't conceive of actually talking about his brand of capitalism as being capitalism.
So, I mean, I think that the place where, you know, I completely agree with Bernie is that we need a new period of reform that's comparable to FDR's New Deal in order to reverse the dramatic increase in income and wealth inequality, and to deal with the pressing challenge of climate change. And again, that if one thinks of capitalism as unchanging, that automatically rules this major period of reform out of bounds, impossible. So, I think that we face this kind of political situation where all of these terms, socialism, capitalism, either are drained of meaning or are so ideologically defined that we become prisoners of our terminology.
Exactly. I mean, just to call for Medicare for all is seen as something that's communist, which seems bizarre. I mean, not by everybody. I mean, I think the view is definitely changing. But I was just reading today about Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez being criticized for dancing, and by some right-wing Twitter account who posted a video of her doing that and called her a communist. And I thought, well, gee, when did $15 an hour minimum wage and Medicare for all and, you know, tackling the problem of climate change be something that's communist?
Exactly. And that, remember also that the Soviet Union fell in 1989 or 1991, and a lot of water has gone under the bridge. So, you know, we haven't been fighting our communist enemy for quite some time. So it's pathetic that the Cold War rhetoric is still confining our political options.
Yeah, and that's very much at the center of your book, Capitalism, the Future of an Illusion. You talk about something called the four corollaries, and I'm going to kind of list them in my own terms and then ask you to explain them. One is the idea that the economy is autonomous or self-regulating. The second is the tension between democracy and capitalism, which is a fascinating thing to get into. The third is the idea that greed is good. And the fourth idea is that it's the investor class who are the heroes. Do I have that pretty much right?
Yes, that's helpful, since I sometimes have trouble remembering what I wrote. But so the kind of centerpiece is that notion that the economy is an autonomous thing. It's something that regulates itself. Its inner laws must be obeyed. And so the reason that we can't raise the minimum wage or take dramatic action to change from carbon-based fuels to renewables is that would interfere with the self-regulating mechanisms of the economy. And this idea is just, when you think about it seriously, bizarre, because there are no institutions that are autonomous and operate on their own. And basically, the economy cannot exist without government providing many of the key inputs that the economy uses. So the money supply, the supply of credit are regulated, provided, governed by governmental institutions. Much of the infrastructure, the roads and the airports that are necessary for commerce to flow, have been provided either directly or indirectly by government entities. One thing I've emphasized in my own research is in the U.S., particularly in the last 40 or 50 years, much of the process of innovation, of developing new technologies, has been lubricated by significant governmental action. So one of my colleagues has pointed out that the Apple iPhone, kind of considered to be one of the crowning achievements of private enterprise, involves 10 or 12 key technologies that were developed by the federal government very deliberately and self-consciously.
Not to speak of the Internet itself.
Oh, absolutely. Right. That was very much a government creation. So this idea that there's an economy out there and that it operates according to its own inner logic that can't be changed is completely mistaken. But it has this, it's a kind of zombie idea that no matter how many times it's slain, it continues to haunt us and to limit our debate. And I mean, if you listen to the political debates in Washington and the explanations of why we can't do this or that, it's almost always we believe in the free enterprise and the logic of the market and so forth.
But isn't it pretty disingenuous, because there's so much what we could call corporate welfare? In other words, the government does in fact interfere without any criticism whatsoever on the part of the powers that be when it comes to subsidizing, say, fossil fuels.
Absolutely. And that's a good segue to this next corollary, because I wanted to kind of challenge a belief which is kind of widespread on both the right and the left, that there's somehow a fundamental contradiction between democracy and a well-functioning market economy. And my argument, so, I mean, the standard argument goes back to the founders and the debates in the Federalist Papers, that the worry that if you went too far in the direction of democracy, the people, the mob, would demand crippling taxes that destroyed any incentive to invest or engage in entrepreneurial activity. And we know that the strange structure of our Constitution, the Senate as a kind of quasi-House of Lords, all of that was designed to make the system somewhat less responsive to the will of the populace. So the founders did have this idea that there was a fundamental tension between democracy and a well-functioning economy, and so they placed these kind of limits on democratic input, and those limits have become much greater in recent years, essentially because of the Supreme Court saying that unlimited campaign donations represent free speech, so as to give even greater power to the wealthy and the big corporations. But I want to reverse that for precisely the reason that you pointed out, because what happens with successful corporations pretty much across the board is that in the first instance they are successful, or in many cases they're successful because they built a better mousetrap. They innovated in some way that allowed them to defeat their competitors. But once they achieve some kind of significant size, they have the resources to make campaign contributions, to hire retired politicians, to build these links to the political system that allows them to trade some of their profits for protection from the market, that they get subsidies, they get government contracts, they get special loopholes in the tax system. It's much easier to make money behind those kinds of protections than to continue to innovate and develop new products. So this is a kind of natural tendency in the system for big firms to use government and their influence over government to protect themselves from effective competition, to assure a continuing flow of profits. And so one of the key functions of democracy, of pressure from below, is to say, no, you can't have those subsidies. You can't tilt our laws in your favor. We're going to demand accountability. We're going to create a level playing field. And so it helps us to understand why historically the U.S., because of its early democracy, had this more dynamic economy, because pressure from below was able to kind of block the consolidation of an oligarchy, of a handful of firms and rich people who controlled everything. And the contemporary reality is that over this last 30 or 40 years in which the right has been so successful, is that they've pushed us much of the way back towards oligarchy, that a handful of giant firms, a handful of extremely rich people, use their influence over the state to consolidate an economic position, to block the emergence of new, more dynamic firms. And the consequence is that consumers get ripped off. Our economy is much less dynamic than it could be. So my argument is the solution to many of our economic problems is more democracy and using democratic accountability to regulate, control, limit the power of these oligarchic firms. So, you know, for example, we know one of the main examples are the big pharmaceutical companies who were granted a monopoly by the government through the patent system that only they can market this drug for 20 years. And then they say, and we're going to charge $1,000 a dose because we want to. And opponents say, no, no, that's price gouging. And they say, no, no, we're in a market system. Well, a market system doesn't allow monopolies. Or when there are monopolies, then you regulate the price, because monopoly and price, freedom to set prices, you know, doesn't make any sense.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with economic sociologist Fred Block about his book, Capitalism, The Future of an Illusion. So let me get this clear then, because I can see in different ways that capitalism, from what you said, that capitalism and democracy are incompatible, and that democracy actually promotes a healthier kind of capitalism. So I think those are two different things, because I know you criticize in this book, Fred Bloch, in the book Capitalism, The Future of an Illusion, you criticize the left for falling into the same trap as the right, in a way, of saying that capitalism will lead to inevitable concentration of power. And certainly Marx talked about that. And that concentration of power means that it's inimical to democracy. You're saying that concentration of power is also inimical to the efficient functioning of capitalism, capitalism as it should be. But isn't it true that it also, because of the privileging of the bottom line, of the profit motive, drives out all other considerations, and that the profit motive will lead to concentration of capital, and therefore the very oligarchy you decry?
Well, what I'm arguing is that the left should be unapologetic about fighting for deeper and greater democracy on the grounds that that is historically how we've created an economy that works for everybody. And that I think that the kind of core point that I'm making is that this inherited concept of capitalism makes it kind of like a creature, you know, a leopard that can't change its spots. And my preferred metaphor is that our economic system is more like an old building, a giant palace built in the 16th century. And you can modify it, bring in electricity and water pipes and repurpose the rooms and reconstruct parts of it to, you know, put in greenhouses and sun porches, and that there's much more room for restructuring and reform than is possible when you kind of compare the economic system to some kind of creature whose modifiability is limited. Is that clear?
Yes, that is. But I guess that leads to another question, which is, you know, there are many people who say, well, we have a political democracy, but an economic autocracy. And I'm wondering how, within the construct of what you're saying, is that we can modify capitalism to serve everybody. But can we do that without modifying the power relationships within capitalism? You know, for example, we can think about the movement of cooperatives, of worker-producer cooperatives, where the power is shared equally. They still participate in a market economy. Are they participating? Is that a capitalist firm? Is it possible to have democratic forms of ownership within capitalism as you see it?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, they have ups and downs, but we know that very economically substantial cooperatives have been sustained, particularly in a number of countries in Europe, and the Mondragon in the Basque Country being a major example. But that's an example of what I'm saying, that the system is much more flexible and open to experimentation and alternatives than those inherited notions allow. And, I mean, even some of them have degenerated, but in California, a lot of the big agricultural crops have been organized through farmer co-ops, you know, some of which have become effectively, you know, very similar to private corporations. And even I think that there are places in the country where internet services are provided through cooperative forms. So all of this I take as indications of much greater flexibility. And so we know, for example, that there a significant number of large corporations that distribute shares to their employees so that they have some element of worker ownership as a way to incentivize employees. So I think that it's part of this agenda that we could, in fact, reform corporations to essentially give employees greater voice, greater power within the firm. And there's no particular reason to believe that that would impair the economic dynamism of the system. In fact, it might very well increase that dynamism.
Right. In fact, we can say that in Germany, for example, I mean, you do have more worker participation. But if I can interrupt you and ask you now one step further, because I think this is a very exciting idea that you have. You know, you're basically in this book, Capitalism, the Future of an Illusion, you're blowing apart the idea that the kind of free market fundamentalism that is really something that has just come about in the last 40 years as getting hegemony over our economic, cultural idea of economics, you know, that's not fixed and unchanging. We can change it. But what about, for example, accepting non-market forms of organization, of economic organization? And I'm thinking of, for example, the commoning movement that we've reported on in this show, you know, where there are commons that are where people own the means of production basically in common and determine it, but it's not a market thing. It's not really part of the market system. It's a different way of organizing. Is there room for those things within an enlarged sense of capitalism or the market economy?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this kind of comes back to that third corollary that the greed is good, and, you know, that essentially the market fundamentalist idea is that everybody should be self-interested at every moment so that they can be attuned to whatever signals that the market is sending so they can maximize their utility. And that's a formula for turning society into a jungle where, you know, it's a war of all against all, that even the system that we have depends upon solidarity, it depends upon cooperation, it depends upon people limiting their greed and selfishness and cooperating, that increasingly at the kind of technological frontier, firms have to cooperate with each other to get a new product to market. And if they're behaving like animals, although that's not really fair to animals, if they're behaving very selfishly, it undermines the cooperation that they need. So absolutely, I guess, you know, one of the kind of powerful historical lessons of the New Deal was that the Roosevelt administration was very aware that electrification of the economy had gone very fast, you know, very quickly in urban areas, kind of starting at 1900. And by, you know, 1933, that most urban areas were thoroughly electrified with tremendously powerful economic, you know, production advances coming with that. But in rural parts of the country, there was nothing. I mean, that it was too expensive for private firms to bring wires, you know, across the vast expanses of the middle of the country. And so the New Deal's rural electrification program essentially lent money to localities to establish co-ops that would basically provide the electricity and pay for the wires that would link to the wherever the electricity was being produced. And that rural electrification project of the New Deal was extremely important in raising agricultural output, because the difference between running a farm with electricity and running a farm without it was huge. But it depended upon people coming together and building these co-ops on something which was outside of the market. So again, we face this big issue in the country of the growing divide between urban areas and rural areas, and rural areas now don't have the access to the internet, the access to cell phone networks that urban areas have, and part of the way in which that problem could be solved is by following that New Deal model of the government encouraging the development of co-ops. So I think there are a lot of different ways in which we can imagine that the process of economic revitalization is going to draw on alternative economic models, alternative economic institutions, and depend critically on values like solidarity and collaboration. I mean, that it's not going to happen if everybody is going out there calculating their optimal self-interest on a minute-by-minute basis.
So that's the producer side, the idea that, you know, there are different ways of producing, and maybe even there's a place for producing outside of the market economy through communal enterprise. What about the demand side? I think this goes to the fourth corollary that you pose in this book, Capitalism, the Future of an Illusion, Fred Block. That is the idea that investors are the heroes, which is usually trotted out for reasons not to raise the minimum wage or not to provide medical care or not to provide, you know, and basically any of these kinds of social goods to people who aren't investors. That really speaks to the demand side. So talk about that.
Well, I think that that these things that the right derisively talks about as entitlements, I mean, the provision of various forms of social welfare or access to health insurance and so forth, that we are thinking about these things, or the right is urging us to think about these things incorrectly, because these are things that people can't get through the market. That the way the market works is that if everybody had to pay for schooling, some people would get really, really bad schooling. And so that's why we have public schools and a public higher education system. Now, the problem is that over 30 or 40 years, we've starved the public higher education system so that colleges and universities have had to raise the fees. And as a consequence, many young people are priced out of higher education. They simply can't afford it, or they end up with this crippling level of debt. Now, my argument is providing that access to higher education for many young people is absolutely critical for the dynamism of the economy. Similarly, access to health care at reasonable costs and at good quality is the ability to retire at 65 or 70 is part of the way in which people maintain a level of intensity of their work effort. So these things are not that the right depicts anything that happens in public provision as kind of parasitical things which make the economy less productive. They depict them as wasteful. But in fact, this is the way that people get services provision that they need. It's part of their consumer package, and it's part of what makes them more productive as employees. It's part of what creates a better functioning economy. So we there have a kind of backwards notion that sees what is productive as wasteful and what's wasteful as productive. I mean, in other words, think of this idea that it's right and proper that some people have $15 billion or $80 billion or $120 billion. There's nothing more wasteful than that. I mean, you just look at the excessive consumption of these people. That represents pure waste as compared to being able to assure that young people with some talent and skills can pursue higher education. That's what's productive.
And it also begs the question of invest in what? I mean, when you're investing in, you know, basically taking over productive firms and loading them up with debt and driving them into bankruptcy, as, you know, folks like Mitt Romney did and many others who are in the hedge fund field.
Private equity,
and
right.
Private equity, that's not particularly productive. And I'm not even sure a billionaire can spend enough stimulatory money for the economy, more stimulatory money for the economy than a whole class of people who are now able to earn $15 an hour minimum wage.
Absolutely. And then, of course, there's this huge issue of the infrastructure that we know from the American Society of Civil Engineers that we're now facing like a $2 trillion deficit over the next 10 years. And that's in terms of bringing our existing infrastructure up to standards. And that doesn't even count, you know, the problem of making our society more resilient in the face of climate change and the fires and the floods and the hurricanes and the other disasters that we know are on the way. So what we've been seeing is this accumulation of great wealth in the hands of a few at the same time that the New York City subway system has, you know, become a disaster area. Bridges fall down. We're more and more vulnerable to the decay of the physical infrastructure of the society, and that we're somehow incapable of kind of recognizing the urgency of making those investments.
Exactly. Well, there's so much more to uncover in your book, Capitalism, the Future of an Illusion. It's a very refreshing look at the capitalist system and ideas about it. And Fred Block, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, well, it's been great, Francesca. Very stimulating conversation.
Fred Block is research professor of sociology at the University of California, Davis. In addition to Capitalism, the Future of an Illusion, he's the co-author of The Power of Market Fundamentalism. Next up, are most American voters really centrists? Find out after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There's a lot of talk these days about how Democrats, if they want to defeat Trump in 2020, will have to forego their progressive agenda and appeal to the center. That's where the voters are, it's said. But what if that's not true? What if it's only a notion that comforts the comfortable, but actually may hurt Democratic chances to take the White House? That's what my guest Les Leopold says in his recent post on Common Dreams, Beware the Moderate Democrat, Why the Centrist Extremists Are an Incredibly Dangerous Political Animal. He draws on research showing that the socially liberal, fiscally conservative centrists actually make up less than 4% of the electorate. And he says a bold platform of economic fairness will appeal to something like 75% of voters, including some Trump voters. Les Leopold has been on the show a number of times before, talking about his books, How to Make $1 Million an Hour, The Looting of America, and Runaway Inequality, among others. Well, Les Leopold, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
The last time we spoke with you, it was about your book, Runaway Inequality. Today we're talking with you about a post that you did with Common Dreams website. It's the title is Beware the Moderate Democrat, Why the Centrist Extremists Are an Incredibly Dangerous Political Animal. And it's not unrelated to the topic of your book, Runaway Inequality. But before we get to that connection, first define for us what is a moderate Democrat within this article.
Well, the moderate Democrat I am referring to is one that says that they he or she is socially liberal, in other words, for gun control, abortion rights, gay lesbian rights, immigration path to citizenship, et cetera, civil rights, anti-police brutality, the whole gamut of social issues, but they're also fiscally conservative. So a person that fits this bill perfectly would be Michael Bloomberg or Schultz. They'll say things like, Medicare for all is way too bankrupt the country. We need to have balance the budget eventually, come down, bring down the huge deficits, can't spend beyond our means, that kind of fiscal conservative. So often in the media, that's branded as, well, there's a moderate voice. You know, they're for an inclusive society, but one that's fiscally responsible. Just turns out that none of the electorate puts themselves in that category. It's a vacuous category. Less than 4% of the American electorate in 2016 viewed that those issues in that combination was the right combination.
So socially progressive and fiscally conservative, you're saying 4%?
Yeah.
Where does that figure come from?
It comes from this voter survey group, which is this longitudinal survey of voters, and they track them, 8,000 people. So it's a gigantic survey, not 400 or 500 like most of the polls we see in the paper, hear about on television. This is 10 times, 15 times bigger. And they track these people, and they ask them a battery of questions, 100 questions, much bigger than an exit poll. So they find out what people really think about clusters of issues. And this one guy brought those issues together along two axes, identity politics kind of axes, social issues axes, and basically inequality, economic fairness issues. And it turns out that people don't line up the way you think they might, that there are actually four groups of voters, not just two, not left-right. It's more complicated. And one of the groups is the smallest, and that's the moderate social, liberal, economic conservative. So you could view, for example, Hillary Clinton that way, that she was good on social issues, but she didn't want to fight with Wall Street. She didn't want to declare war on the billionaire class. She was about equal opportunity, but not very much about equal results. And I think the same could be said maybe for Gillibrand, Booker, Kamala Harris. They're leaning more in that direction, and I think that that's a loser.
And how can you actually tell? Because, you know, Cory Booker and Kamala Harris and Kirsten Gillibrand have signed on to economically progressive populist
programs. Well, they can't ignore it. They can't ignore it, but they will be kind of tame on economic fairness. They're not going to go, I don't think, look, I hope I'm wrong, but they don't appear to me out of the box going for economic fairness in terms of redistribution of wealth, the billionaire tax, the Green New Deal, the strong Medicare for all. We'll see where they line up on that. But let me tell you about the other three groups, because this is where it gets really interesting. The group that I would put most progressives in, self-defined progressives, is a group that is both socially liberal and wants to tackle runaway inequality. And that's about 45% of the electorate of 2016, and it continues to be about that. So that's, these people are progressive up and down the line. And then there's the hardcore Trump people who are totally not interested in rectifying inequality and are down on all the social issues, really are nativist, are, not particularly fond of, the increasing role of minorities in society, or the second, want to protect the Second Amendment, anti-abortion, et cetera. That's about 23% of the electorate. So it's a smaller group, but that's diehard red. And so we have diehard blue, diehard red. The contested terrain, which is about 30% of the electorate, roughly, are people who are not entirely sold on all the identity issues, but are very strong on the economic issues. you know, very worried about inequality and unfairness and the wealthy running away with, you know, basically the society. But they may have, they could be devout Catholics and have trouble with abortion, or they may be concerned about too much immigration, et cetera. So that group is what Trump needs to win. He got enough of that group, pulled them in for him to win. And so these were basically economic progressives, but socially conservative.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Les Leopold about his post on Common Dreams, Beware the Moderate Democrat, Why the Centrist Extremists Are an Incredibly Dangerous Political Animal. Now, is this the reason why in poll after poll, some 70% of the American people are in favor of things like Medicare for all, a $15 minimum wage, free public college tuition, and a Green New Deal?
You're correct. That's exactly why. Because people are fed up with runaway inequality. They are experiencing it, even if they can't put a name on it. Every day they experience it, and they want big, bold solutions to what are incredible problems. A whole generation, I mean, let me just, in a nutshell, explain runaway inequality. For a whole generation, wages of the average non-supervisory and production workers stayed flat. That's 80% of the workforce. They haven't got a raise in terms of real wages after inflation for a whole generation, since 1980. So that's a long time. Meanwhile, the ratio between top CEOs and the average worker went from 40 to 1, $40 for them, 1 for us, to 800 to 1. So there's this incredible shift of money up to the top, and working people have been screwed. So they feel this, they know this, they can see it, especially in areas that are, the lower-income areas, both urban and rural, experiencing this being left behind. So what this leads to is there are two strategies for getting enough votes to defeat Trump. Trump's strategy is obvious. He is going to try to use the identity issues to hold on to that group of people that are progressive on economic issues but more conservative on social issues. He's going to try to wedge them away from the Democrats by getting the Democrats to constantly talk about those issues. But there are two strategies for overcoming that. One, which I think I've heard a lot of progressives talk about this, is that we should forget about the economic issues because that's just appealing to the white working class. And what we should do is increase the turnout of women, minorities, and you know, overcome voter suppression, register more people to vote, encourage the young people who are more progressive to come out to the polls, and basically build the kind of almost victory that Abrams had in Georgia. And she articulates this perfectly. She says, you know, we just have to basically dig down deeper and get more of these people to the polls. And we can then start to flip Georgia, Arizona, Texas, et cetera. And don't worry so much about Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, the old kind of working class, supposedly white working class, you know, Rust Belt areas. The other strategy is to say, reach out, go beyond your base, and start pounding away on these economic issues and make sure that the people who really care about that do not go to Trump. And so this would be like the steelworkers. About half the steelworkers voted for Trump because they were so fed up with trade, so fed up with their job loss. And these were people, these were not, some of them, you know, might fit the stereotype of working class racists, but many of them voted for Obama twice and voted for Sanders, supported Sanders, but then flipped over to Trump. Those people are very reachable. So another group of people, and I'm in that group, would say, talk to these people. Don't just talk to people that agree with you. Talk to people that disagree with you. And don't write them off. Don't make them be kind of pure on every litmus test that we progressives, you know, believe in. Give them a little room and have a dialogue with them about runaway inequality. Our program, which can be seen at runawayinequality.org, our educational program, which we're taken all over the country, shows that this can be done. We can talk to Trump people and have a very productive conversation about what runaway inequality is doing to our society, to our families, et cetera.
But is it really an either or? I mean, I was watching.
Everybody's going to want to do both.
Yeah, because I saw CNN's town hall with Bernie Sanders, and, you know, he was basically asked this question. There's polarization, the extreme left, the extreme right. What are you going to do to bring people together? And, you know, he basically gave the answer that you did, which is that most people want to have economic fairness and that we need to also talk about identity issues in terms of racial disparities, because it tends to be that people who are, you know, people of color tend to be in worse off economically, but that there's not really a contradiction between the two.
Well, I would say that the proof is in the pudding. We'll see who can have that conversation and pull it off and be credible. I think it's going to be depend a great deal on how it's put forward by the candidates and whether it's credible and what the attacks are going to be. I think there already have been a lot of attacks on Bernie for being not strong enough on the women and identity issues because they see how hard he tilts towards, you know, he really presses on the economic issues. We'll see who's credible in that way.
But he disputes that, and he made a very strong case for no contradiction between identity politics and economic fairness.
Right. He can say whatever he wants to say. Mm-hmm. The question is whether or not it rings true to the people he's saying it to, not to us. Is he going to be able to, let's see how he does at a town hall in, you know, rural Iowa, rural, you know, Ohio, et cetera. Let's see how he pitches it. If he can do both, more power to him. I would argue you can't do both unless your economic message is very strong. That's what the point I was trying to make in the article. If you moderate your economic issues because the media is basically telling you you're too far left, you're too anti-capitalist, you know, so forth, if you do that, then I think you can't do both. And the people you'd be appealing to then don't exist, because if you pull back on your economic message, you're going to be socially liberal, economically moderate, and there are very few people that fit into that category, and you'll be missing what I think is behind both the Trump victory and the blue wave, which is this tremendous anger against inequality. So no, it should not be an either or. What I'm saying is, don't trim your sails on the economic message. I think Democrats have to be for justice and fairness, you know, for all people in this country. You can't pull back on that. But you have to add, you can't waffle and try to play up to your rich donors. And, you know, Gillibrand is the senator from Wall Street. She's not going to say a bad thing about Wall Street. You're going to have people, you know, Biden's already taking large, you know, amounts of money for his speeches. We'll see how that all plays out. You know, people who are trying to play it more to the middle economically are going to shoot themselves in the foot, because they end up, those Trump voters that are really worried about that are not going to come back to the Democrats if they don't hear a strong economic message. I think actually Sherrod Brown, does it very well.
Yeah, one has to look at the records for sure. Interestingly enough, I did hear an interview with Kirsten Gillibrand, which really surprised me, because she came out very strongly on the economic fairness
right.
issue. So, you know, it is interesting how the Overton window is being pushed more towards the progressive end of the spectrum, where people are now, you know, it's more acceptable to talk about these things. But I wanted to ask you, what you've established, or at least this, you know, large polling data establishes, is that it's only a minuscule 3.8% of the electorate who are socially liberal / fiscal conservatives. The problem is that the media treats the moderates as the majority, so that everybody thinks that in order to win, you're going to have to play to that 3.8%.
Yeah, well, this is what's so interesting. Look at who the media is. Who are they? These are people who have not been hurt by runaway inequality. They've been one of the few groups that's actually, if you're a major player in the media, you've done very well. You've earned a good living, as they say. So what's happening is these folks are kind of reflecting their own class interest without even realizing it. And obviously the large, you know, the spokespeople that get airtime tend to be people that have done very well. So you have a moderate consensus, socially liberal, economically conservative, based on a sort of echo chamber amongst themselves. the journalists that actually do research, they're the ones who turned me on to this particular study, saying, hey, there is nobody behind a guy like Schultz, you know, the Starbucks guy who's running, who claims he's fiscal conservative and socially liberal. There are people who do research that read these polls understand this, but the people who are on the air don't really have time to do that, and they just sort of reflect, you know, they talk to each other. They all sort of are doing well, very well, really, and that's the kind of world that they see. But you know what? I don't think they have that much influence.
Hmm. Why is that?
I think people get their media sources from so many different places now. It's not like Walter Cronkite anymore that's like laying out, you know, what kind of America is. I mean, you have CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and CNN versus Fox. And if you listen to the two, it's like, you know, one is gaga pro-Trump, and the other one is basically ripping them up constantly. So, you know, who are they influencing? Now, they can influence Democrats, MSNBC, but I don't think everybody gets, you know, people are sort of following them word by word. I think people are going to judge them based on their appearances and the debates. And I think that the way the candidates, you know, it's a real Darwinian process. I mean, you got to be really solid to make it through as many debates and primaries as we're going to see coming up and starting this early. Whoa. So we'll see how it plays out. But I'm glad that Gillibrand and maybe the others are picking up this idea that they should be appealing very heavily on these economic issues. That's the way to do both. I don't think just drilling down on, you know, sort of who we are and getting more people like us to the polls is enough. It's too dangerous a strategy to write off 30% of the population because of, you know, of some litmus test.
And Les Leopold, your article, Beware the Moderate Democrat, Why the Centrist Extremists Are an Incredibly Dangerous Political Animal, is so important. Such a great addition to this discussion. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Les Leopold is the author of several books, including Runaway Inequality. His website is runawayinequality.org. Find links to that and his article at Common Dreams at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.